Indeed, here I am. My guest is Dr. Nick Begich, who for years and years now has been investigating electronic, all things electronic, electromagnetic radiation weapons and electromagnetic radiation stuff. Not just weapons, but, things like RFID technology. You know about those RFID tags, right? Well, there's some connection with our cell phones and RFID tags. I have no idea what it is, but in a moment, we together will find out. All right, back now to Dr. Nick Begich. Indeed, Dr. Begich, there's some apparent relationship between RFID tags and cell phone technology.
Right. This technology, RFID tags, in fact, in terms of how they're being used, are being put in virtually everything. And as the cost for these tags continues to drop, the thought is they will eventually end up in the currency itself. And I'm going to read a really short quote. It's from July 3rd, 2001 from CNET News, and it says, and I quote, "Hitachi has developed a chip that could be woven into paper money to help identify counterfeiters and could also have wide ramifications for identification and surveillance technologies. For example, chips could be implanted into all paper money and be connected wirelessly to the internet so that authorities would be able to monitor the movement of all cash." Now, this gets connected not just through cell phone technologies, which now interface easily with the internet. They're virtually all set up for that, the newer phones. The connection is, think about Bluetooth in the wireless world, where supposedly when you walk into your home, your various appliances will eventually know that's you and the coffee pot will know to turn on and so on. Well, that requires a unique identifier tagged to the individual. This is where the cell phone really comes into play, because when you think about it as your personal communicator device, something uniquely ID'd to you, that's the beginning of that porthole to hook you into those systems. Now, think about currency being developed in this way. So when you go to the bank and you cash your check, they know exactly which bills you hold. So then you go transfer those bills at the grocery store and maybe at the garage sale, but the guy at the garage sale doesn't have a reseller ID, a business license, or what have you, but the IRS knows he just collected money because sometime or somewhere along the line, he goes and spends it. In other words, every single cash transaction, every single movement, as you put that cash in your pocket and you run around town and you go buy these little wireless receivers and transmitters that pick up those little bits of information to know that that's you moving across town, they can literally track every movement you make. And this is the invasiveness of this technology, because it will be used, again, for our safety and security and to get rid of the black economy in terms of, again, using international drug trafficking, international terrorism as the rationale for absolute control and tracking of all currency transactions. When you think about that within the cell phone regime, it's just one reflection of that, because right now so much data is collected. It's been used in criminal cases as far back as the 1990s in Switzerland, when they would track the movements of people. When you start to look at RFID tags in conjunction with this, they're going to be on everything. When you go to the store and you buy a shirt, it'll be in the tag. So the next time you walk in the store, they'll know, John Smith is back. They watch John Smith's movements, see how he reacts to various...
Okay, let me stop you for a second. I want to understand. Maybe I don't understand RFID tags correctly. It was my understanding that an RFID tag, for example, on a shirt you would buy,
right,
or something else, was to stop theft, so that if you walked through, the little...
Right.
That's not what it's for?
No, I mean, certainly it can be used in that way, and certainly it is used in that way. But an RFID tag is an inventory tracking device. And what does that really mean? Now, from the standpoint of a store, they want to know everything they can about you as a consumer. Everything they can tag to you individually allows them, on a finer and finer basis, to target advertising you're most likely to respond to.
Sure.
Advertising is going to become so personal that they won't even talk to you about things that your profiles indicate you're not going to be interested in. What they call in Europe now data valence, taking data and looking at your data shadow is what they refer to in the European Parliament. All of the transactions, all of your behaviors that can be warehoused in data banks and analyzed by very sophisticated computer models can then project what you're going to do, what you're going to buy, what you're going to respond to. This can be used even politically. I mean, if a candidate, for instance, could figure out what the one issue out of maybe the 100 issues that you disagree with, there's one that you agree with, that's the only message you'll ever hear from that individual during the course of a campaign. That's the way this data is going to be developed, so that you
only get...
All right,
talk to me, doctor, about RFID tags specifically. When I walk out of a store with a shirt with an RFID tag... What can that RFID tag, is it an active transmitter? No, it isn't,
no.
Is it?
You have to be close to a system that can read it. And that's where the Bluetooth and some of these other technologies that are emerging that are basically proliferating everywhere. I mean, they're going to be every place. So as you pass these various positions that can then send the signal to activate the tag and read it, because a lot of the corporations now are cross-linked. In other words, they share their data, they share their information. The more they gather, the better the profile, the better the marketing, and the easier it is to target the marketing. And it's
that
about the marketing, not just about security.
All right. So how do I still don't get how RFID tags and cell phones go together.
From the standpoint that the cell phone becomes the easiest device to use to trigger. I mean, if you're carrying your phone, you've got your own ID identified easily because it's your telephone. Being able to activate an RFID tag using the cell phone as the activator is where we see that technology going, where cell phones become an integral part. I mean, for most people, young people particularly, they don't even get hard lines anymore. They get a cell phone. That's the only communication they have. Everywhere they go, everywhere they move, that data is stored. And it used to be stored just short periods of time because storage was expensive. Well, storage isn't expensive now. You store everything indefinitely, and it's getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper to do. And so the RFID tag provides, from the standpoint of commerce and marketing, a way to track virtually everything a person buys once these things are integrated into every inventory item. And the big commercial merchandisers are insisting that this happen as rapidly as possible because it offers them incredible opportunities to mine the data and look at the data and hone their marketing in a way that really not only becomes manipulative in the sense that you only get information that you're most likely to respond favorably to, and you're denied information that you would find objectionable. And, you know, when you think about that, you really want full disclosure, you know, when you make decisions. Maybe some things like buying a pair of socks doesn't matter, but perhaps electing an official or making some major purchase, it does matter. And you're not going to get that full information. It's going to be tailored specifically for you. RFID tag offers a method of inventory control, but it also offers a method of controlling the flow of all goods, all services, all currency into a single system of integration.
What do you know about RFID tags and currency? Where are we with that? That one concerns me now.
Well, we're pretty close. I mean, the cost now is down to where I would suspect that within the next 5 years, you're going to see it implemented. And you're going to hear the announcements and the proclamations about why it has to be done for our own safety and security and to get rid of the drug trafficking and the money flowing out, plus counterfeiting, international counterfeiting by states like Korea, for instance, copying our money and circulating, you know, millions of dollars. These kinds of problems are getting more and more news play, which to me is usually the first, you know, sort of the prelude to what's coming. They create enough anxiety over the problem. People start getting burned with bad money, and then they want a more secure bill, and then this becomes the outcome. And
yeah, but is it really? I mean, it seems everything we do can be undone. So if we can RFID currency, then some jerk is going to be able to duplicate RFID currency.
Sure, I think that just goes. I think that definitely goes on. You know, these things will be serialized, so there might be some unique way to do that. But you're right. I mean, almost every technology at some point or another, and that's been the chase on currency. You know, we've seen our currency in the U.S. change more in the last 10, 15 years than we ever saw before as they try to get ahead of the counterfeiters. This is just one more step. And I agree with you. I think there's a certain amount of insecurity that we have to accept, because the idea of tracking every single bill, for most people, when you raise this issue, the first objection, you know, starts to come out. Well, wait a minute, you know, why would I want everything I do tracked in this manner? And most, I have not met anyone yet who thought it was a great idea.
Okay, clear something up for me. The newer bills, some of the newer bills have this almost teeny little metallic vertical strip in them. What is that?
That's it's an ID. It's a unique ID. I mean, you can pull the strip out. If you split the bill at the top, you can actually lift that strip right out.
Really?
And it's a Mylar film. Some have suggested that it's already got some capability of being read. I don't know whether that's accurate or not. You know, I've heard that, but I have not seen. And you know how I am about documents. If I don't see
so they don't tell us what that is then.
They say it's a Mylar strip for avoiding counterfeiting, because it's very tough to weave into the fabric and to get this to get this actually in the bill. So it's kind of a super safety thing. I mean, if you look at European currency, the euro, for example, you'll see these same filaments woven into the paper, along with multicolors and all of the things that we do, ink blots and so on, to try and get something that's more difficult to counterfeit. And I think that's basically been the premise, is this would make it much more difficult. You can't Xerox, for instance, like some people have done, pick that up. I mean, you really have to have pretty sophisticated capability to counterfeit that. And that's where we're seeing governments like Korea doing some of this, because they do have the ability and they do have the budgets. It's cheaper to print money, I guess, than to get it legitimately, and even they figured that out.
All right, so you don't think it's anything more ominous than that? You don't think it's some form of RFID tag?
At this point, I have not seen anything that would indicate that. I don't have access to all the information out there. There may even be listeners that have information on this, but I've always stuck with whatever the documents support, and in this case, I just don't have anything that would support that Mylar strip being an RFID tag at the present time.
Okay, I know there's a very great deal of worry here in the Philippines about the validity of bills. And whether it's U.S. currency that you're exchanging or it's pesos here, they look at every bill. They examine every bill so carefully.
Right.
So there's a lot of forgery going on. No question about it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. So eventually you see cell phones actually activating RFID tags, and then see, here's the part I don't understand. If it's for marketing purposes, I cannot imagine, let's say, a large chain being able to go out and massively activate cell phones, activate RFID tags, and get marketing information by the millions and millions and millions, which otherwise I just don't see companies getting that kind of technology in their hands, or our government allowing that to occur. Is that what you see?
No, I see it the other way. I see the providers collecting data and then marketing that data in terms of, in terms of whatever they can collect. I mean, already you're looking at data banking. And when you start to think about, what do companies have to sell? They sell their mailing lists. They sell all kinds of data. But when you can get specific profiling, I mean, credit card companies do this all the time based on your transactions, and then they sell the lists that you can actually request in a very tailored way to get a certain demographic and a certain zip code that with certain buying patterns, you can already do a lot of this. So the idea of larger organizations collecting data, that data is extremely valuable to marketing entities. I don't see like a private company going out and then activating a bunch of cell phones, but I do see the cell phone company collecting a lot of data and then utilizing that data in a way that that builds markets and builds markets.
Do they have that legal right?
It's a good question. A lot of the laws are ill-defined because the technologies and the laws have not sort of matched each other. In recent years, for instance, electronic harassment using the internet was not prosecutable in most states. And yet, if you harass somebody with a telephone or the mail or personally, you could be arrested. But because it didn't deal with the internet specifically, I was a victim of such harassment, and that's what I found. Alaska finally changed the laws. But laws have not kept up with much of the technology. The issue of privacy as it relates to technology, we need a complete review of where...
All right, now here's where you're making it just a wonderful point. And let's go backwards. I think what I said earlier, that congressmen and senators absolutely have got to have now on their staff some sort of technological liaison, somebody who really knows what the hell's going on, because obviously they don't, and they're politicians. They're worried about getting reelected, and they can't possibly keep up with technology and the speed with which it's changing. They just can't. So they need liaisons on their staff. Is that something that's happening now, or if it isn't, then it needs to?
There's not enough of it, and it's like technology translators, people who can read through actually... They need to be cross-disciplinary teams, I think, within the Congress, of people that have enough knowledge across the disciplines to sit down and analyze technologies and review their implications in advance of, you know, in advance or else in conjunction with deployment. Because things are happening so fast, it's almost like it runs out in front of us and we go, oh, wait, there might be consequences here. And then we try to catch up and we never catch up. We need that sort of cross-disciplinary review and a little more surface discussion in terms of the technologies. Much of what happens in this area is driven by commercial interests that are interested in collecting the information. My eldest son has his master's in e-commerce, and he had actually looked at some of the theoretical models being developed for using data collected electronically. And the companies that he's worked for and the background that he's had, what we know is that the entire networking of data is really so valuable today, because spending money on advertising, I mean, people can spend it here or there, but directing it specifically and targeting it in very specific ways is where advertising is headed. I mean, that's where most sophisticated advertisers are already going. Most of the big academic institutions are looking at ways to hone that so people's advertising dollars are even more effectively spent at influencing outcomes. Political outcomes, particularly, I mean, now for presidential elections, $1 billion gets spent. That's a big budget, and there's a lot to be said for using data and then manipulating data.
Mm-hmm. What about this movement? It's only beginning experimentally right now, but they actually are beginning to implant chips in human beings. Now, they've been doing it with animals for some time, for probably a good reason. Now, what about chips and human beings? What do you know?
Well, you know, down in Mexico, the Attorney General's office planted several 100 employees with microcircuits under the surface of the skin. When you go back again to the document Revolution, Military Affairs, and Conflict Short of War from 1990, the U.S. Army War College, they did, at that time they could basically monitor location, you know, for GPS purposes. And for special forces now, they utilize them where if you're in combat, they actually know your location. But more than that, the new chips can actually determine heart rate, respiration, many of your physical perimeters, whether you're breathing at all or dead, where you're located. I mean, a lot of data. Some of the most sophisticated circuits, MIT released a story several years ago where a microcircuit the size of the first numeral on a date of a dime is used for medical diagnoses. The newest chips, the ones that are being developed today, are even getting smaller. I mean, when they're looking at the capability of microcircuits, given the direction of the technology, being able to get so small that what we used to have, you know, I mean, think about computers. What used to fill a house now fills a watch.
Oh, of course. And look, all of this, for example, as it would apply to, say, a special forces soldier, is completely understandable.
Absolutely. I would support that 100%. And if I were in combat, I think I would probably even take the chip just to know that I could be extracted.
You bet.
But in that paper, they talk about implanting business travelers. And the idea was we wouldn't activate the system, of course, unless there was some problem. And if you believe that, you know, I mean, I think we need to reexamine the whole issue. But the idea of positive ID, you know, in terms of ID coming in the passports, here After the first part of the year, they're going to require biometrics, the ID of something unique identifier to you within your passport. If you want to get through customs a little faster, in the most obscure place, Alaska Magazine, Airlines Magazine, December 2006, writing down on the airplane, they're now putting iris scanners in the Vancouver International Airport, and you can give an interview, photographs, fingerprints, and background checks, and your iris scan, and then you don't have to go through customs in the way everybody else does. This is the trend and direction in which all customs and all transits between countries will eventually take place.
Wow.
And they've already done it in Canada, and they've already done it at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, and have it active as Schiphol Airport iris scans for at least 4 years for those frequent travelers that don't want to be bugged by customs.
So right now it's voluntary. There are a lot of people out there, people of faith, who think that the Bible says that eventually the involuntary chip is coming. We'll be right back. Suppose our government came to you along with everybody else and said, look, for the safety, for the threat that we're all facing, it has come to the point where everybody is going to have to be implanted with a chip that will identify them, a chip that will assure all of us that you're in the company of what is known to be a safe person. Underline safe, I guess, as many times as you want to, or a person known to have been safe previously. I'm not sure how it would work, but another good citizen is in your company or in our company. Would you take that chip, or would you bring out your Bible and say, no, it's the mark that we've feared, we've all feared and talked about for all the years that I've been alive, the chip that we must all take, or we do no commerce, the involuntary chip. That's coming right up. All right, Doctor, we're going to go to phones at the top of the hour, but I've got a number of questions I want to clear up fairly quickly if I'm able to.
Okay.
And the first is that involuntary. That's the big one, of course. Is that where we're headed when eventually we're going to... I mean, they've talked about national ID cards. This is
right.
Just the modern version of a national ID card, a chip in your hand or wherever they'd put it, right?
That's correct. And, already they've piloted some of this, not with... with the microcircuits, primarily with special service personnel, they're talking more about, the military IDs that they put out with a lot of information a number of years ago. This is the next logical step because, again, counterfeiting issues, how do you counterfeit a human being? You know, once they stick this under your skin, you're definitely ID'd in a way that is irrefutable, indisputable. The problem is exactly what you're suggesting is this is the ultimate control of the individual, and I don't believe that's anything like what the founding fathers envisioned, and certainly violates some religious tenets. And I think that's going to be where the tension is, because this is going to be one of those issues that unites the left and the right together, whether it's for civil liberties purposes or for biblical reasons. It's going to bring people together around a common theme that freedom and liberty, the things that bind us together, and allow that diversity within this culture have to be preserved, and is preserved on a platform of privacy and integrity of the individual. These things violate that integrity. The idea of manipulating people, controlling people's movements, should be an affront to any free people anywhere on this planet. The other issue, and the issue that kind of creeps and overlaps, is the areas of, and what we had talked to in the last hour, about the idea of manipulating even human behavior. Now, when you start to overlay all of these technologies, you get a very directed and controlled society where people are reduced to taxpayers and consumers rather than the human beings that we are. These are invasive technologies that, on the one hand, give us the illusion of security, and on the other hand, strip us of our very humanity.
Indeed. All right. Well, I think that's where the... the foot would come down. I don't think that would. There are just too many people of faith that wouldn't allow it to happen. I want to circle back to something we talked about earlier, the ability to turn on a cell phone, use it as a bugging device. Now, we can have arguments about whether it's justified with the threat our country faces right now, but that's not the nature of my question. My question is this: if it's possible for the providers to really do this, to turn on a microphone and a cell phone and listen, then why isn't it possible that some little genius out there will figure out what the providers already know, if in fact they do, and the ability to listen to anybody's cell phone will fall into the hands of private detectives and then ultimately just to a very bright individual?
Well, actually, it's already possible. According to December 1st, 2006 article that appeared on CNETnews.com, that whole issue of private investigators already have the capability, but they say it's illegal, so they can't do it. Now, anyone who's been around very many private investigators knows that there's a lot of things they do that may not be legal, and they do it because they're not necessarily using the information for a criminal or civil case. It's for other purposes. A lot of rules get violated because you can. Technology, being able to hack or write code that you could download into phones, I mean, every system is vulnerable. Even the Joint Chiefs of Staff, according to an article that we clipped, had Chinese hackers get into their personal and private databases. So, you know, tapping into cell phone technology, apparently, according to the article, is not a problem for anyone with the will, desire, and a little bit of financing and ability to write some code. And, you know, when we look at that across the board, think about, you know, this whole direction of warfare and info war deals with the idea of being able to hack the other guy's system. The more technologically dependent we are, the more vulnerable we also are to these kinds of intrusions. In the case of China, we know from the research that comes out of the Senate Intelligence Committee that is released that this is one of their primary areas of interest, is how to hack through into our infrastructure systems and utilize them. If they could figure out a way to hack into the congressional cell phone lines, believe me, they will do it, and they may already be doing it because the technology, if it's available to private investigators in the United States, is available to anybody running any sophisticated government anywhere in the world.
What a world. All right. We wanted to cover something called electrosmog. Now, we are, of course, radio, television signals, microwave, all of these things are completely invisible. If they were, in fact, visible, we would be inundated. We wouldn't be able to see 2 inches in front of our face. All of this is passing through us and around us all the time.
Right.
Is there something associated with electrosmog that's new that we need to understand that's affecting us biologically in some way?
Well, yes. And when you start to look at it from the standpoint of stress within the population, you see it dramatically increasing. And electrosmog as a concept, there's actually a paper, you can find it on SwissRe.com, which is Swiss Reinsurance. So the people that write reports for underwriters and insurance companies so they don't take unnecessary risks. They have a report called Electrosmog. It's been out for a number of years, but it basically says to the insurance industry, don't insure these risks. In other words, the risks are so great, they say that in the event that the biophysicists are correct, and the insurance industry is insured risk, it'll bankrupt the insurance industry. So they do not. Even Lloyd's of London, for instance, won't insure cell phone risks based on electromagnetic emissions coming from the phones because the risk is too great. When you start to see the insurance industry say, hey, the evidence is in, we're not insuring the risk, even though the scientific community might want to still argue about it, insurance companies don't argue about what they're going to lose money on. They just take the
savings. So you're telling me that insurance companies have turned down, I don't know what it would be, some sort of insurance for cell phone manufacturers, perhaps against a class action lawsuit, that sort of thing? Is that what we're talking about?
That's exactly right. And we covered this in the book Earth Rising 2, The Betrayal of Science, Society, and the Soul. And it's really, when you start to look at the technologies in terms of cell phones and cell phone safety. And just if you take RF alone, radio frequency energy alone, from what nature naturally produces in the background, we've added 200 million times more radio frequency energy surrounds us every day. And that's what's called electrosmog. I'll tell you when you notice it, the changes, including the power grid that surrounds us at 60 cycles. When the power goes down, the first thing everyone feels is how quiet it is. Obviously, the motors aren't running. But you almost feel like your whole body exhales and you relax because your body is compensating for these external fields all the time, trying to find equilibrium. As soon as you remove those fields, the stress is relieved, the body relaxes. And that level of stress, when you think about it in urban areas, I left Alaska in the background. Radiation was pretty mild. I've got a detector that goes from 50 megahertz to 3,000 megahertz for microwave radiations, and it makes very distinct noises when you're around it. In my home in Alaska, I got nothing, virtually no signal. I came down here to Dallas in this hotel room, and everywhere I go, this thing gives me a reading that tells me I'm inundated with electromagnetic fields here in the microwave range that I was not exposed to in my home state of Alaska, as an example.
I'm certain that's true. Wait until the next time you travel to Las Vegas. It has more two-way radiation than any other city in the world. And so next time you travel to Las Vegas, let me know how your meter does there. So you believe there are there scientifically verifiable biological effects from this?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the finest biophysicists in the world, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Alexander K. Varanen, he was a former head of the biophysics lab for the USSR Academy of Sciences for 10 years. He was at labs director in biophysics. He is one of the most brilliant. He's a visiting professor at 12 universities. He spent 6 weeks with me in Alaska at one occasion, and he's being brought into a closed conference of a number of specialists in the same league to discuss some of the ramifications of these technologies. The Lay Institute on Technology is actually sponsoring a closed conference, and I'm bringing together about 9 of the best scientists in the world. Their CVs, their resumes, fill up an inch and a half thick notebook, and they're going to sit down with us and look at some of the most invasive technologies and begin to develop strategies for public education in these areas. And, you know, what we know from the biophysics is that electromagnetic fields have incredible effects. Alexander K. Varanen even did a paper, it's over 900 pages long, of a number of the effects of electromagnetic fields. On his websites are extensive documents. He even gets into some of the more esoteric subjects and breaks down the physics for some of these things, from new energy to the biophysics of how the body actually reacts to these various forms of radiation. So it's not so much a new area as it is a new area for the public. Biophysics is an old field. Electrophysiology, the first degrees were granted back in the 1940s. Jose Delgado, who was famous for his mind control work, actually had a degree in electrophysiology from 1950 from the University of Madrid, over 56 years ago. So, you know, these areas have been studied consistently for over 6 decades. The only thing that we've learned is that it takes less energy than we originally thought, that the real trigger is the frequency. It's almost like dialing in a radio station. When you get resonance between the transmitter and receiver, you get a nice clear signal. And the same is true in the human body and the human mind and learning.
What do we know, Doctor, about what frequencies are more dangerous to biological entities, in other words, us?
Well, I mean, very specifically, you know, when you look at the brain can be overridden by external sources of energy. It's called FFR, frequency following response. You can use electromagnetic fields. You can use the flicker rate of a television set screen. You can use any carrier to carry a signal that will interact with the brain. And then you can put yourself into, for instance, if you're watching a television passively and you can control the flicker rate of that TV, you're already in a passive position. You can put the individual into a highly suggestive receptive state. This does not violate any laws, by the way, as long as you're not using subliminals, and you wouldn't need to, because what happens is the brain then drops into this state of accepting the information without much filtering, and that happens within the 30, 40 seconds of watching the advertisement. Then the overt advertisement words sink in, register, and most people sit on the fence anyway. this is enough to kick it over the top. That's the way in which a lot of this technology is and will continue to be applied. You can use any of these perimeters, and there is a huge body of research. We found over 300 sources and a number of patents that actually show the evolution of that technology, the state it is today. And that book was reviewed by two physicists, both of whom, in specialists in biophysics, said it is the absolute best on mind control that they've ever read, because it's
all right. But again, doctor, what I'm asking is, what frequencies that you're aware of are more dangerous to biologic entities than others? I mean, we've got a whole range, virtually from where sound ends and radio emissions begin, up to light. Now that's a big area, and some must be more dangerous to others than others, rather, in that spectrum.
The extremely low frequency signals appear to be the most biologically active. This is below 1,000 hertz. Although there are some harmonics in higher frequencies that create biological action as well, but it's this lower range. I mean, when you think of the human brain operating primarily in its deepest states of sleep, 1 to 4 hertz or pulses per second, and then sort of in between sleep and awake, or where more 3 to 5 year old children spend their time, is in the theta range, 4 to 7 hertz. 7 to 12 hertz is where we are when we're in our most creative states, the alpha state. And then above 12 hertz, you get into beta. Now, when you go high beta states, 60 hertz, 70 hertz, you're getting into a highly agitated state, one where the brain is not operating at its optimum. This is where the danger starts to take place. Now, you can dial in. Every chemical, every compound, every body organ has unique frequencies. If you want to look at the gross body organs, you can go to the dosimetry handbook, the radio frequency dosimetry handbook produced by the University of Utah under a contract to the United States Air Force Science Advisory Board, where they broke down the specific frequencies for every vital organ in the body and how to override those vital organs using external energy sources.
Wow.
And that's a public document. It's not classified. It's available. If it's classified, it's only been in the last couple of years. But that is, in fact, the breakdown. And what's interesting about that paper is they don't talk about scalars. They only talk about vectors, except in one place in the definitions. In other words, all the parts that dealt with scalars were extracted. Those are classified. They left it in the definitions section, which is kind of interesting. But this whole area of science, that was a 1985 study. That is 20 years old. I mean, they already knew then. When we traced the evolution of these studies through the military, we did it in a way that really broke it down, showing how they evolved their work and their models. And now what we saw, there is an open RFP by the military. We quote it in the book, Controlling the Human Mind. It's open until the year 2009, soliciting information, specific information on how to override and manipulate the body and the mind and the chemistry of the body using external energy sources.
All right. Well, here's what I would say. Most of this then must be totally at this point experimental, because if we had the ability to control minds, if we had the ability to control populations in any way at all, I mean, look at how desperate things have become in Iraq. Obviously, we have not loosed this technology in Iraq in any meaningful way, or we'd be doing a lot better than we are right now. And certainly, it's a desperate situation at this point.
Yeah, you know, again, you know, we have our own people intermixed with what's going on in Iraq. But if you go back to the first Gulf conflict, Commando Solo was used, a project by the military where we use a very sophisticated a set of aircraft that actually interdict and get involved with the communications within a country. So what we did in that case, according to Scottish press, was we embedded signals on the radio broadcast broadcasting the Muslim music and prayers, and we put in signals that created anxiety and fear. And what did we see? The fourth largest army in the world give up like kids on their first fire drill. But we did not have our troops intermixed. We were still outside of those battle zones. We were
coming
into. That's
a very good point.
And so now we're intermixed. Now, what they have introduced to the battlefield is this new device. It's a radio frequency dish mounted on a Humvee, supposedly to create heat sensations on the skin. It created a lot of controversy a few months ago when the Secretary of the Air Force, and I forget how you pronounce his name, I think it's Wynne, W-Y-N-N-E, came out and said, we need to test all these non-lethal weapons on Americans before we deploy them against our adversaries. And right after that, they deploy this crowd control weapon in Iraq. Now, what they didn't tell people is by changing the frequency, pulse width, many different perimeters about that microwave radiation, according to the radio frequency dosimetry handbook, you can create more than just heat on the surface of the skin. You can manipulate or shut down any of the vital organs within the human body. And that's something they didn't bother to mention, but it shows up in all of their literature. One of the companies that have developed some of these technologies is a company called ADCO, A-T-C-O. It's owned by Woody Norris, who developed microwave heterodyning for transferring sound information directly into the brains of people where they hear that proverbial voice in the head without any physical contact on the body. And he won the MIT Lemelson Prize last year, $500,000 for that invention, something he said was possible.
Doctor, hold it right there. Dr. Nick Begich is my guest, and I'm turning him over to all of you next. We've certainly covered a lot of ground, so if you have questions, and I'll bet you do, that's coming up next. This is Coast to Coast AM.